I'm Mike Herhold, president of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of myself and the board to our December 2019 program. Of course, our very special speaker for today is Vatican correspondent and perennial Akron favorite, John Allen. Please silence your cell phones so that we can all enjoy today's program. After the presentation, you'll have the opportunity to write down questions for our speaker. After the talk, we'll have a short announcement break and collect those question cards, and then we'll have a brief question and answer session. It's now my pleasure to introduce Our Lady of the Elm Senior Class President, Rachel Simonton, who will offer our opening prayer.
Thank you. Dear Lord, we ask that you bless this event and everyone involved. Please bless our speaker and allow us to be enlightened by what he has to say. Please help us to make all of our words, thoughts, and actions pleasing to your name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Rachel. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, John Allen, who really needs no introduction. Please welcome him back to the First Friday Club of Greater Akron. Hello there, Akron. How are we all today? Now, I know every year that I come here, I always start by telling you how much I love Akron and how much I am thrilled to be back, and I know many of you may suspect that I am simply blowing smoke or gilding the lily. You probably think I say that to all the girls, but I can promise you I have proof here today that I am pleased to be here. And my proof is this. I just spent the last month in Key West, in Florida. It is where I try to get sometime every year when the weather turns cold in the global north. I have been going there the better part of 20 years. I feel like a true conch by now. And every morning I was there, I would trundle down to South Beach, which is the southern end of the island. It's where the sun comes up every morning. I would take a dip in the ocean, and then I would lay there floating on my back, watching the sun come up, one of the most majestic sights you were ever going to see on God's earth. Every evening, I would go down to Mallory Square, which is on the other end of the island. It's where the sun goes down, and you would sit there in the pier over the water, watching the sun come down, usually enjoying a libation or two. And it is just the most glorious and relaxing experience you can possibly imagine. So a couple of days ago, I was sitting there on the pier at Mallory Square, my last night in Key West, watching the sun come down, and I was feeling the agony of having to leave pervade every molecule of my body. What got me through, ladies and gentlemen? What buffered the blow? It was the thought that soon enough, I will once again be in Akron, Ohio, with my friends at the First Friday Club. That is an honest-to-God true story, by the way. That thought did pop into my mind sitting there. Now, it may have been addled by the fifth mojito by that stage in the day. But I do always look forward to being here, in part simply because you people are great. You are kind, and you are interested, and you are passionate about the same things I'm passionate about, and it's always a pleasure to be with you. But also because, in a small way, this series, the First Friday series, is the Faith in Action. It's about lay Catholics not waiting for officialdom to provide solutions to you, but taking leadership, acting for yourselves, creating something of value, and then sustaining it over the years. Those are easy things to say and remarkably difficult things to do. The fact that you have done it at such a high level of quality is remarkable. I spend a great deal of time on the Catholic lecture circuit in the United States. I can tell you this is not common, what you have accomplished here. You should be proud of it, and it's an honor for me to be part of it. And so thank you for having me again here today. Now, on to business. I have been asked to talk to you about Pope Francis and where things stand in the church. So, you know, let's wrap that up in just a few minutes. You know, and then I will cure cancer and leap tall buildings in a single bound. I want to begin with two caveats that need to be laid on the table with any conversation about Pope Francis. One, Pope Francis is the Energizer Bunny of popes. This man does not have an off switch, okay? He is a constant whirlwind of activity. And therefore, picking up any single piece of the puzzle runs the risk of being reductive, of engaging in an analysis of the forest for the trees. I'm going to try to give you a representative sampling this morning, or this afternoon now, of things that have happened over the last year since we were last together that illustrate some of the larger themes of this papacy. But I need to emphasize to you, it is only that, a representative sample. Should we choose, we could take the conversation in a variety of different directions that might leave you with a different impression about the Pope and what he is up to. So just know that any conversation about Pope Francis over any span of time runs the risk of being incomplete, impartial, and therefore potentially misleading. Now, secondly, and I know you live in Ohio, you don't need me to tell you anything about partisan politics. And of course, we are again in election season, aren't we? Although I might profitably ask, when is it not election season in America? But we are definitely in it now. And in similar fashion, pari passu, conversation about Pope Francis, both inside the church and out, has become heavily politicized, ideologized, polarized. On one end of the spectrum are people who are more enthusiastic about Francis than Francis is about himself, and who are congenitally incapable of acknowledging any potential liability, wrongdoing, misstep, or lapse in judgment. On the other end of the spectrum are people for whom Pope Francis by now is, in effect, an anti-pope, the embodiment of all that was wrong about the Catholic Church before he got here and is now even worse, who is leading the church down a path of doctrinal confusion and collapse, disciplinary disintegration, compromise to the forces of worldliness, and who therefore have, as an article of faith, are incapable of acknowledging even one single thing this pope may have done that has been constructive, useful, well-advised. Now, I am, of course, describing extremes, but the truth of it is there are more people clustered around those extremes than you might imagine, and they seem to spend all of their time in social media. If you follow Twitter or Facebook or Instagram discussions of papal affairs, you would think everyone is there. Of course, not everyone is. But it needs to be said that in particular these days, in any conversation about the Pope, the rule of caveat emptor applies. You need to consider the source before you reach conclusions about the credibility of the information that you are receiving. Because there are, unfortunately, a number of outlets out there, including some of my colleagues in the media business, who are no longer engaged in a dispassionate effort to get at the truth, but who are engaged in trying to advance a partisan agenda. We will try to still steer clear of that as much as we can here today, but just know that is always a complicating factor in the broader discussion. All right, with those two caveats on the table, let's talk about four major moments in the papacy of Francis over the last year, which illustrate different aspects of the larger story. I am going to talk today about the clerical sexual abuse crisis, the Synod of Bishops on the Amazon, the Pope's recent trip to Thailand and to Japan, and his ongoing efforts at Vatican reform. And in every case, I need to warn you that reality in each of these tales that we have to tell is a mixture of shadows and light, successes and failures, frustrations and accomplishment. That is true of any papacy, just as it is true of virtually anything else we can think of. So, let us begin with the clerical sexual abuse scandal. And by the way, I'm going to try to do all this in about 25 minutes or so to leave plenty of time for questions and answers. All right, it has been now almost a year and a half since the scandals around former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick erupted in the United States. You all know the story. Theodore McCarrick was the Archbishop of Newark, then the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, having begun his career as a protege of Cardinal Terence Cook in New York. He rose to the pinnacle of power in the Catholic Church and remained there for the better part of two decades, until in 2018, what had long been in the categories of rumors about sexual misconduct around ex-Cardinal McCarrick burst into full public view in the form of accusations of abuse and misconduct, abuse against young boys, minor boys who had been altar boys, misconduct with adult seminarians. On the basis of that, Cardinal McCarrick was immediately stripped of his red hat as a member of the College of Cardinals, and not long after that was laicized, meaning formally expelled from the priesthood. So he is now, as we used to say, reduced to the lay state. The Code of Canon Law now says returned to the lay state, which I suppose is more charitable. But in any event, he is in effect a private citizen. He is living in the same place he was when all this first blew up. He's living in a small Capuchin friary in a place called Victoria, Kansas. Ironically, it's about 11 miles from where I grew up. That friary is where I was actually taken as a young man to be sort of exposed to what the Capuchins do in their ministries. The problem, it's not, by the way, that the Capuchins take any particular joy in hosting him. They were asked to sort of take one for the team, and they agreed to do it. McCarrick ultimately would like to go back somewhere in the East Coast. That's where his family is from. The difficulty is finding a place that will take him. By now, he needs nursing care. And apparently, every Catholic nursing home on the East Coast has said no. So they are trying to find a facility that would be willing to care for him. I mean, you can imagine their situation. They don't necessarily want TV scrum showing up on their doorstep every day. They do have other clients to think about and the stability of their operation. So it's a difficult situation. I would say, and this continues to be an ongoing story for the following two reasons. One, in the wake of the McCarrick scandals, the U.S. Bishops' Conference vowed to adopt a new system of accountability for bishops who cover up charges of sexual abuse. They did so at their most recent November General Assembly, but we've really yet to see a test case of those new norms in practice. The other reason this remains a topical story is because last year, in late September, the Vatican vowed that it was going to commission a study of all of its archives to try to establish who knew what when about McCarrick, and was going to release that information in due course. It has now been 14 months. That report has not been released. However, we understand it has been prepared. And we are told it is likely to come shortly after the holidays, that is, sometime in early 2020. And that, of course, will renew attention to the McCarrick saga as well. I would submit to you that where things stand today, the McCarrick story perfectly illustrates both the forward progress and the unfinished business of the clerical sexual abuse scandal. It's forward progress for this reason. What it illustrates is that at least in the United States and in other parts of the West, now this is certainly not true in other parts of the world. In Africa, Asia, many parts of Latin America, Oceania, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, this cannot be said. But for our part of the world, it is now abundantly clear that there is swift and sure accountability for a cleric who sexually abuses a child. What is going to happen? There are now strong and inflexible protocols in place. What will happen is that when a report comes forward that is judged to be even minimally credible, that cleric is going to be suspended, that is removed from ministry, pending an investigation, and the report will also be relayed to the civil authority, meaning police and prosecutors. Now, in McCarrick's case, that was irrelevant because the statute of limitations for what he's accused of had long since passed. But that report will nevertheless be relayed to the police. And if the charge is found to be credible, that priest is both going to be laicized, that is, permanently expelled from the priesthood, and subject to police prosecution if that's possible, and also to civil liability if the victims or their families want to pursue it. That is now clear, and we now know that there are no exceptions because even a cardinal was held subject to those new standards. That is progress. That is something that did not exist in the Catholic Church as recently as a decade ago when I first began covering this story. Well, I actually began covering this story a long time before that, but I can tell you that that even as recently as a decade ago, it was not clear that that kind of accountability would be enforced and that it would be enforced across the board. It has been. We've seen it with our own eyes. Now, the unfinished business, however, is that the story of the McCarrick scandal isn't just a story about crime. It is also a story about cover-up. Because there were rumors about misconduct around first Archbishop and later Cardinal McCarrick reaching back into the early 1990s. It is obvious that the system did not respond to those reports with the kind of aggressiveness that we would now feel appropriate. It is also clear that at some point during the Benedict papacy, information regarding McCarrick that was deemed sufficiently serious to warrant this measure was passed along to Rome, and some kind of confidential sanction was imposed on McCarrick. He was asked to stay out of the public eye, asked to reduce his travel and his activities, both on the part of the Vatican and on the part of the U.S. bishops. That information, however, was never relayed to anyone, never made public, so that when there was a transition in papacy, McCarrick was able to resume his activities as a kind of informal diplomatic troubleshooter on behalf of the Vatican. There have been charges, of course, that that information was relayed even to the new pope and that action wasn't taken. Now, we don't yet know exactly how to assess who knew what when, because we have not seen that Vatican documentation that we are awaiting. But what we do know is this. It is inconceivable, and no, I'm not channeling the Princess Bride. I do know what this word means. It is inconceivable that Theodore McCarrick could have remained at the pinnacle of power in the Catholic Church for two decades without someone having his back, without someone being aware that there were charges against McCarrick and not choosing to pursue them. To date, however, absolutely no one has been held accountable for that failure. That is the unfinished business of this situation. What we now have in the Catholic Church in America is a very strong system of accountability for the crime. But to date, a new and untested system of accountability for the cover-up. And I would suggest that until equally strong accountability for the cover-up is put into place, until all of us see senior officials being held accountable for the failures, I don't mean imagined ones, but I mean real failures to take action where action was warranted. Until we see that happen, I don't think many people are going to be convinced that this story is over. And the only thing I can tell you is stay tuned, because early 2020 promised to be a fairly dramatic period in that regard. We may see the first test case of applying this new system that the U.S. bishops adopted with the recently resigned Bishop Richard Malone in Buffalo, who does face abuse allegations. And we should also see that Vatican report. And once we do, we can begin assessing exactly where culpability lied and whether, in fact, we have been told the full truth. So it is an unfolding story, a moving target. In terms of Pope Francis's personal role in all of this, I can only tell you what victims who speak directly to Pope Francis on this issue have told me. And victims do have regular access to the Pope. Juan Carlos Cruz, for instance, who is a Chilean survivor of abuse by that country's most notorious pedophile priest, Fernando Caradima, is now one of the closest one of the Pope's closest advisors on the clerical abuse scandals. And what Cruz always says of Francis is that Francis's heart is in the right place. He wants to do the right thing. However, where things get complicated is when Pope Francis receives assurances from bishops of action that will be taken when they go home, and then the follow-through is somewhat inexact. Now, you know, in the end, how does one assess? I'm sure that's true, but, you know, how does one assess that? Ultimately, who is responsible for that follow-through? Ultimately, it's the Pope. Now, of course, holding reluctant bishops' feet to the fire is hardly the only item a bishop has, a pope has in his agenda. But on the other hand, if you believe that the clerical abuse scandal is the Protestant Reformation of our time, that is, it is the most significant shock to the Catholic system probably in the last 500 years, then you could also make a compelling argument that this deserves to be the top item on the Pope's agenda. So I think the only assessment can be that the Pope's will is on the side of the angels. It is on the side of the of reform. The follow-through and implementation to date has been incomplete and inexact. Jury is still out. All right, let us shift to the Synod of Bishops for the Amazon. Now, you know, I don't know if any of you were following this event at a distance. I was in Rome for every day of it, and I can tell you, I think it is probably the closest I will ever come in my life to covering a three-ring circus. If P.T. Barnum had produced this thing, it could not have been more theatric. You know, the backdrop to this, of course, is that Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina, Pope Francis, is history's first pope from Latin America. The Latin American bishops in recent decades have made the defense of the Amazon rainforest and the roughly 400 indigenous communities that live in that rainforest one of their top priorities. So it is a keenly felt personal priority of Pope Francis. He decided to summon this Synod of Bishops on the Amazon. He announced it 2 years before it actually happened in order to provide ample time for preparation. And the idea was to try to mobilize the resources, beginning with the church in Latin America, but radiating out from there to the entire global church, in defense of the ecology, the environment in the Amazon, also in defense of human rights for the communities that live there, social justice in terms of land use and things like that. Now, all of those issues, once the Synod actually started, all of those issues were very much in the mix. They do figure prominently in the Synod's final document. However, two other issues came to dominate. And I will tell you, this is not an instance of the media foisting a fake agenda on an event. I am sorry to tell you, that does happen sometimes. But this is not a case of it, because these issues were important inside the Synod Hall, and they were also extraordinarily important in the larger discussion around the Synod. And I can, the two issues were these. I will give you the phrases, and then, because neither one of them mean a great deal to the average person, I'll unpack them. Phrases are the viri probati and inculturation, and more specifically, the Pachamama. All right, beginning with the viri probati. Viri probati is a Latin phrase for tested men. And it is a phrase that has come to be used in Catholic conversation for the idea of ordaining older, stable, married men who are pillars of their community. Some of them may already be deacons, some of them may be catechists or play other roles in their parishes. But ordaining them as priests in order to be able to serve underserved communities. And usually the idea here is isolated rural communities who do not have regular access to a priest. Let me give you a news flash, ladies and gentlemen. This is often a bit staggering for American Catholics, but here it is. You know, we complain about priest shortages in the United States, don't we? I mean, you know, sometimes we see parishes closing or clustering because we don't have enough pastors to assign to all of them individually, and we think we have it rough. Do you know what the ratio of priests to baptized Catholics in the United States is? We have about one Catholic priest in the United States for every 1,500 baptized Catholics. Now, it depends a little bit on where you live, but that's the overall national ratio. Okay? Do you know what it is in Latin America generally? It is 1 to 7,800. Do you know what it is in the Amazon? It's 1 to 13,000. Okay? So however bad we may think we have it, it is infinitely worse in many other parts of the world. Some of these isolated rural communities, these 400 indigenous communities I was talking about, many of them are lucky where they live to see a priest once a year who will take a jeep down to the dock wherever he lives, get in a boat, then transfer to a kayak, and then hike through and hack through a jungle trail in order to find this settlement. Maybe he goes Easter time, maybe he goes on Christmas, maybe he goes whenever he can get there, but that's it. Okay, that's the only time a year these people are able, therefore, to participate in the sacraments. And so the Viri Probati has been raised for a number of years as a proposal by bishops, some bishops in Latin America, as a solution. The issue, we knew this issue was going to be debated heading in to the Amazon Synod. And indeed it was. It was intensely discussed. And there were views on all sides. I think in the main, some of the bishops and other participants in the Synod saw this as a common sense, almost no-brainer, pastoral solution to a particular problem. Others worried that it amounted to a kind of surrender on one of the traditional pillars of priestly identity in the Western Church. Also wondered whether it would really work. I mean, there are many Protestant traditions that are also present in the Amazon, all of whom have married clergy, and it's not like they're able to get out to these places any more often than we are. It's not like they have clergy surpluses. So there was also the practical question of whether this would solve the problem. This debate wound on. In the end, while there was healthy disagreement, more than two-thirds of the bishops of the Synod in their final vote did vote in favor of asking the Pope for permission on a limited regional basis to experiment with the Viri Probati in the Amazon. Now, of course, the Synod of Bishops, this is not the United States Synod. They can't make decisions on their own. All they can do is recommend stuff to the Pope. So the ball is now in Pope Francis's court. We are told that the Pope's concluding document from the Synod is expected in March. So perhaps sometime by March we will have an indication of whether he is going to grant this permission. Critics feel, or worry, I should say, that if he gives permission for the Amazon, it won't stop there, that this will be a Trojan horse that will eventually lead to the unraveling of clerical celibacy across the entire church. Now, I would note historically that people said the exact same thing in the 15th and 16th centuries, when several Eastern Rite churches with married clergy came into union with Rome. They are fully Catholic and have had married clergy for five and six centuries now. It has not led to the unraveling of clerical celibacy in the West. People said the same thing in 1983 when John Paul Grass granted the pastoral provision to allow clergy who were Episcopalian and married to come into communion with Rome, remain married, and be ordained as Catholic priests. And that hasn't led to the unraveling of celibacy either. So we shall see. But in any event, Pope Francis has not yet tipped his hand in terms of which way he plans to go on this, but it is a major piece of business that is sitting on the Pope's desk. And I'm going to make one prediction to you of which I'm absolutely certain. No matter what the Pope does, somebody will be unhappy. All right. The other big issue at the Amazon was enculturation, the idea being that that Catholicism isn't, Christianity isn't supposed to be a foreign import in the cultures of the world. It is supposed to take root in those cultures and be at home there. And in part, that learns being able to find ways to show respect for, appreciation for, the traditions, the language, the customs, and so on of these cultures. Now, in the abstract, I don't know that anybody would really disagree with that. You know, where it gets tough is when things get concrete. And at the Amazon Synod, ladies and gentlemen, things got concrete, and therefore they got tough. Because the organizers of the Synod had invited a number of indigenous persons from the Amazon region to be there for the month to be part of the discussions, and they brought their dress and some of their cultural symbols with them. One of these symbols was a small figurine, so it's a wood carving, so it's like mahogany, polished, of a kind of topless pregnant woman, okay, who was kneeling in a kind of prayer posture. And this figurine was at a prayer service that the Pope hosted in the Vatican Gardens 2 days before the Synod began. It was also present in a canoe at the opening procession of the Synod, and then it went on display in the Chiesa di Traspontina, which is a church very near the Vatican, just down the Via della Conciliazione. And bishops from the Synod would go there every night after the day's work was over, often to say their masses, and so this symbol was kind of ubiquitous. Now, what, you might ask, did that symbol represent? Well, that's a darn good question, and to be honest with you, we in the press corps had a very hard time getting a straight answer on that at the beginning. Depending on who you asked, and by the way, the figure got nicknamed the Pachamama because the Pachamama, it refers technically to an Andean and Amazonian fertility god that is sort of venerated by the Incans. It wasn't technically correct because none of the people who were carrying this figurine around were Incan. But I think the word Pachamama stuck. Pachamama, it's just a cool word. And two, because there's a very well-known disco bar in Rome called the Pachamama, and I think it just stuck in people's heads. But in any event, so the question is, you know, what did this figure actually represent? Well, at the beginning, some people said that this is a native indigenous depiction of the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of the Amazon or something. Other people said, no, this is a pagan idol. It's like the golden calf in the Old Testament, right? Vatican spokespersons tried vainly, gallantly, to suggest it had no religious significance at all. It was actually just a symbol of life. Now, unfortunately, apparently none of these Vatican spokespersons had ever read any Margaret Mead, because if you had, you would know that there is no such thing as an artifact of indigenous culture that has no religious significance. They don't acknowledge the separation between the sacred and the secular the way that we do. So that was just hogwash. But placating hogwash, I guess, was the idea. And this debate over what it actually represented, you know, raged on for a good 3 weeks until it finally occurred to someone to ask the people who had actually made it, you know, what they had in mind. And they said, well, I mean, it's sort of a fertility symbol. It's a symbol of veneration for life. But, you know, it's not a, we don't dance around it or have satanic rituals. I mean, it's just something that you would find in homes as a way of symbolizing that life is sacred and our respect for life, right? Which reasonable people probably would have accepted. It's just we weren't dealing exclusively with reasonable people. And so what happened is towards the end of the Senate, a couple of guys videotaped themselves early one morning going into the Church of the Traspontina and stealing these figurines and then trundling down to the Tiber River in Rome and throwing them in the river, I guess, in a kind of ceremonial purification thing. One of these guys, who's part of some traditionalist Catholic outlet, by the way, because this is the 21st century, this is what you do. After this YouTube video he shot bragging about this made the rounds, he was questioned by police, but then released because eventually they got the statues out of the river and gave them back. So I guess the theory was no harm, no foul. But he's now on the lecture circuit and making a minor career out of being the guy who grabbed these statues and threw them in the river. He's got a book and CD and lecture tour, and this is just what you do. So the moral of the story is this. What made the enculturation debate at this Senate so dicey wasn't the concept. I think probably conceptually, there's not a great deal of theological agreement that if Christ came for all, then his followers, his family, ought to be at home in all cultures. But the difficulty is when you get concrete. What does that actually mean in action? How far can you go towards incorporating, adopting, rebranding, if you like, expressions of indigenous spirituality, indigenous beliefs, indigenous worldviews, before you cross the line to something that is no longer authentically Christian? In other words, I think what we had was theoretical agreement but operational confusion. And I think, no doubt, the Pope, in the document with which he will conclude the Synod, will call for further forward momentum towards deeper and more pervasive enculturation. And it's going to be very interesting to see what that looks like operationally around the world. I suspect these are choices that will be with us for some time to come. All right, very quickly, let me touch upon Thailand and Japan and Vatican reform. So the Pope's recent trip, it was late November, to Thailand and Japan, was probably his most important foreign trip of the last year. Significant on many levels, but let me just talk about one. The Pope chose, while he was in Japan, to visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those, of course, are the two cities that were devastated by U.S. atomic bombs at the end of the Second World War. They are probably the most evocative places on the planet to talk about nuclear weapons and the nuclear arms race. Pope Francis went there to repeat something he had already said, but obviously being in Hiroshima and Nagasaki gave it a much higher platform, which is he is moving the Catholic Church, not in its principled analysis of nuclear weapons. The Catholic Church has been anti-nuke from the dawning of the nuclear age. However, in the John Paul years, at the height of the Cold War, there was a kind of grudging acceptance from the Vatican and from Catholic officialdom of the concept of mutual assured destruction. The idea was it is what kept the peace during the Cold War. Now, popes and Vatican documents would always be clear that that had to be transitory. It could not be a point of arrival. It had to be a point along the journey to complete disarmament. But nevertheless, there was an acceptance that kind of rough equilibrium somehow maintained the peace when the global situation was dominated by two rival superpower camps. Well, of course, that's no longer our situation. We live in a multipolar world where the real nuclear threats these days no longer come from West and ease. But they come from pariah states, and they come from non-state actors such as terrorist networks. And in that context, Pope Francis has moved the church towards a much more stringently abolitionist position. And he announced in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that he wants the Catechism of the Catholic Church to be amended to reflect that. That it's not merely the use or the threat of use of nuclear weapons, but their manufacture and their possession that is gravely immoral, an offense against God's law. And obviously, he's trying to move the church into a more activist stance with regard to the nuclear abolition movement at a time when many people consider it pretty moribund, rather frozen in place. Remains to be seen how successful the Pope will be with that endeavor, but it is a clear example of how Pope Francis is not simply an ad intra pope. He's not simply concerned with moving the levers of power inside the church. He is also very much an ad extra pope, concerned with trying to leverage the church's human and political capital to make a difference in the broader world. And finally, Vatican reform. You know, I know I've spoken to you before about Pope Francis's sort of on-again, off-again efforts to reform the Vatican. He was elected in March 2013 on a reform mandate, in particular with the charge to clean up Vatican finances. And early on, he created a number of brand new structures and brought in new personnel. And there was promise of a kind of root and branch reform. Later, that momentum seemed to be stalled. Where are we today? Well, if the question is whether the Vatican has been reformed to such an extent that it is no longer capable of being caught with its pants down financially, I am sorry to tell you that is not the case. Because most recently, just within the last few weeks, a rather significant new scandal erupted in Rome, where it turned out the Vatican's Secretariat of State, that is its most powerful central coordinating department, had spent about $200 million, well, 200 million euros, so about 225 million U.S., to buy about a 50% share in a piece of property in London, in the rather Tony Chelsea neighborhood. It's actually a former Harrods department store warehouse that is slated for conversion into luxury apartments. They got in this deal with an Italian financier who is now under indictment. And when they realized they didn't want to be in bed with that guy anymore, they tried to spend another $175 million to buy 100% ownership of this property. That's when things got hinky, and somebody waved a red flag inside the Vatican, and so the transaction got stalled. What has happened in the wake of that is the head of the Vatican Gendarmes, that's own internal security agency, has been fired. The head of the Vatican's Financial Information Authority, that's its anti-money laundering watchdog, has been fired. Other officials have been suspended and apparently are under investigation. All of this unfolding against the backdrop of the fact that the Pope recently appointed two new people to head his financial reform project, one of whom is a veteran Italian banker. And if you think a veteran Italian banker is the remedy to obscurity in financial affairs, I've got some property I would like to sell you in the swamps. We will see, but I think a lot of people are dubious. And the other guy he appointed is a fellow Jesuit, a Spaniard, who was in charge, apparently, for about 5 minutes of his Jesuit province's own financial operation, but other than that, has no particular experience or background in dealing with international financial systems. So while these are new appointments and we have to see how they play out, I would not say they were the two most reassuring moves that any pope has ever made in terms of seriousness about the reform endeavor. I think the objective thing that can be said is that after 6.5 years, which is roughly where we are at with Pope Francis, the Vatican, to the naked eye and to the external observer, today does not feel significantly more financially transparent and accountable than it was before this reform cycle began. Now, there certainly has been forward movement. I mean, it is true that this transaction that is at the heart of the recent scandal was brought to light because one of the Vatican's internal reform mechanisms actually worked. Unfortunately, it's the reform mechanism whose head just got canned. but in any event, it is, in one sense, I suppose, evidence of the system working. But in general, I think the consensus would be that more or less, in terms of the financial operation of the police, it is business as usual. Now, the question, of course, that begs is why? Why hasn't the change been more dramatic? Why hasn't it been more sweeping? Why hasn't Pope Francis done more? And I think here we enter into the realm of the speculative. I can't give you an objective answer to that question, but I can give you my speculation. Here are the facts of the matter. The facts of the matter are every one of the most recent popes came into office vowing a financial reform of the Vatican. Paul VI did. John Paul II did. Benedict XVI did. Francis did. Okay? And each one of them took significant steps at the beginning of the papacy. And yet, somewhere along the line, it kind of ran out of steam and business as usual reasserted itself. Now, why is that? Well, here's what I think. I think at some point during each one of these men's papacy, they got out of bed one morning and realized that if they were going to seriously recalibrate the internal operations of the Vatican, and in particular its financial operations, which are so interwoven with the Italian scene that it is very difficult to imagine it otherwise, that if they were seriously going to do that, it would require their every waking energy for the rest of their papacies. And I think every one of them decided they simply had bigger fish to fry. You know, John Paul II initially wanted to bring down communism, and then he wanted to heal the rupture between East and West and do battle with the spreading culture of death. Benedict XVI wanted to promote a rapprochement between reason and faith. You know, Pope Francis wants to leave behind a poor church of the poor. I think in their minds, these are all bigger projects than tinkering with the internal structures of the Vatican. That is not an excuse, but it's the best I've got for you as an explanation. All right, that's an overview of where we stand with the ongoing Pope Francis saga, but here's what I can guarantee you. That's the story as of December 6, 2019, but this is Pope Francis we're talking about. Stay tuned, because there will be something new to discuss tomorrow. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the First Friday Club of Akron.
Once again, thanks to John for those fascinating insights, and gives us lots of things to think about and gossip about with our friends and family. Please write down your questions if you have some, and hold them up in the air so that one of our volunteers can pick them up. Our next First Friday will be here at Tangier on the second Friday of January, on January 10th. With a presentation by the panel of local lay ecclesial ministers. If you're listening to the podcast of this website, we invite you to join us in person. You can make reservations by sending a check for 20 to the First Friday Club, 795 Russell Avenue, Akron 44307. You can call our phone number 330-535-7668 each month, or online at the Eventbrite site. If you order tickets ahead of time and have a package, you need to let us know the Tuesday before that you are coming if you haven't selected specific dates. We do have multiple packages for 6 months, 9 months, and 11 months. If you want to hear a podcast of a previous speaker, that can be found on our website. If you're not on our mailing list, please make sure that we get a copy of your email, and you'll get notices from us. I'd like to now recognize folks who are here. I'd like to recognize students from Archbishop Hoban, Our Lady of the Elms, St. Vincent, St. Mary, and Walsh Jesuit High Schools. Please stand. Are the folks from St. Mary's Elementary here today?
Yes.
And St. Mary's Elementary. I'd also like to recognize any of you folks who are first-time attendees. So if this is your first time, stand up or wave if you've never been to First Friday Club before. Welcome. Please come back. And now I'd like to recognize the members of the First Friday Club board. Please raise your hand. Got some questions for me?
Yes. I'd like to say, first of all, we could have a woman take care of the finances.
Okay, I've got a question, but first, those of you at the student tables, I want a show of hands. Raise your hand if this was better than being in class today. Thank you very much. All right. The question, can you comment on Francis and the role of women in the church, possibility of female deacons? Well, the second one is easier. The issue of female deacons was discussed at the Amazon Synod, and there was a recommendation from those bishops to basically restart a study of the question that Francis had started a couple of years ago and then kind of shelved. I think there was a clear majority of bishops in that synod who would like to see some form of the female diaconate. Again, we will see in March what the Pope has to say about it. The broader question about the role of women in the church, Francis does not miss any opportunity to talk about this. I mean, he constantly talks about trying to find ways to empower women, short of priestly ordination, of course, but every other way he possibly can to see women in significant, meaningful positions and roles in the church. I would say the record in terms of doing that so far has been a little spotty. As far as your point, by the way, I mean, who he names to be the next sort of tip of the spear for financial reform, that is a classic example of a position in the Vatican that is meaningful because the power of the purse matters, but it does not require a Roman collar. There is nothing in church teaching or tradition that would stipulate that the Vatican's chief financial officer has to be male, or for that matter, has to be in holy orders. The same thing is true of many other significant positions in leadership, both in the Holy See and other levels of the church. So, my response to this is, I think what needs to happen is that the base needs to keep holding people's feet to the fire. There is a lot of rhetoric out there about empowering women, about making sure that, to use the Pope's language, they are present in the rooms where decisions are made. Okay? That rhetoric is on the record. I would say, let's see it in action. With the election of Archbishop Jose Gomez as president of the USCCB, that's the U.S. Bishops' Conference, do you see him as the most influential U.S. prelate? If not, who would you say is? Well, that's an easy question. Jose Gomez is not the most influential American prelate, at least under this papacy. The most influential American prelate by a country mile is Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago. He was a personal appointment of Francis. He has been named to absolutely everything that the Pope cares about. There would be very little question that he is Pope Francis's go-to guy in the United States. If by influence we mean influence in Rome, if we mean ecclesiastical influence. Now, you know, if we mean broader cultural influence, I think that's a little bit more hard to say. I would just say this. I think the election of the first Hispanic president of the U.S. bishops, and probably the U.S. bishops' leading champion of immigrants and immigration reform, heading into an election cycle in which those issues are likely to loom large, that is A, not coincidental, and B, potentially mammothly significant. And I think it will be very fascinating to watch the role of the U.S. bishops collectively and Archbishop Gomez in particular as their president and their leader as we get deeper into 2020 and the debates that are inevitably going to play out during this political season. How influential Gomez will be on the outcome, I do not know. But I can guarantee for the next several months he will be the highest profile prelate in the United States because a Hispanic leader of the country's largest religious denomination in an election cycle in which immigration and the religious vote are expected to be extremely crucial. Hard to imagine that we won't be seeing a great deal of Jose Gomez in the months to come. China and the Vatican clarify. Good God. Well, I mean, you know, here's the deal. The Pope made a big deal with China recently, right? Struck a big deal. The Vatican and China made a deal for the appointments of bishops in mainland China. Essentially, the nature of the deal is China proposes three candidates that are acceptable to them. The Pope picks one. And in theory, everybody's happy. This was designed as a deal, the long-run impact of which would be two things. One, it would gradually overcome the long-running sort of cleft in China between an officially recognized above-ground church and an unofficial underground church or church of the catacombs, and two, that it would pave the way towards diplomatic relations with Beijing. Those were supposed to be the long-term fallout. The short-term fallout was supposed to be that it would ease up restrictions on religious believers in China because the Vatican and Beijing had just made nice. Now, critics will tell you that exactly the opposite has been the short-term effect, that in fact, especially in rural areas where the Christian population tends to be concentrated, the crackdown on believers after the Beijing-Vatican deal intensified, became worse, and often local officials would tell the Christians as they were bulldozing their churches or rounding up their pastors, that the Vatican had said it was okay because they just made this deal. And so Beijing and Rome, you know, were in lockstep. And obviously they weren't hearing anything from Beijing to disabuse them of that notion. Critics will also say that they believe that the Vatican gave up way too much in this deal for very little, and that popes for the last several centuries have fought and sometimes paid in blood to preserve Rome's autonomy to name bishops, and now we are essentially giving it away to a country, well, a regime that does not exactly have a history of benevolence with regard to the Catholic Church. And so there is skepticism about how all this is going to play out. Meantime, there is kind of intense diplomacy on both sides. In fact, just today I was noticing that the most recent issue of Civiltà Cattolica, which is the semi-official Jesuit-edited journal that contains stuff that the Vatican wants out there without necessarily having its fingerprints on it, its most recent issue is entirely dedicated to China and has a fairly glowing, rosy take about how relations are evolving. I think the only thing that can be said with